asking is Jenkins against the Price Waterhouse Pension Plan, or Disability Plan, sorry. Mr. Dubofsky.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Charles Jenkins. Connecticut General Life Insurance Company had to meet a higher-than-marketplace fiduciary obligation according to MetLife versus Glenn. Despite that obligation, the insurance company deliberately and flagrantly abused its discretion by terminating Charles Jenkins' benefits despite progression and worsening of his condition of AIDS after nearly 12 years of the insurer's acknowledgement of Mr. Jenkins' disability. Its acceptance of the same treating physician's opinion for 10 of those years, and notwithstanding findings made both by its own in-house claim representatives and physicians, and despite its own independent medical examiner's opinions.
Did any of the plans physicians physically examine your client?
If you're referring to Drs. Kern and Taylor, no. If you're referring to Dr. Shockley, who was retained by Connecticut General Life to perform an independent medical examination, yes. Dr. Shockley conducted a detailed physical examination, rendered findings, and concluded at the end of her report that it is uncertain whether he could perform sedentary activities at work for 40 hours per week without frequent work breaks or work absences. She further described the natural history and progression of AIDS as one of unpredictable recurrences of significant illness and possible incapacitation. And then again, after the functional capacity evaluation was performed and Dr. Shockley was asked whether she agreed with the evaluation, she indicated that she disagreed with that evaluation because she anticipated that there would be a significant likelihood of fatigue limiting Mr. Jenkins' ability to function.
Who was the decision maker with the said that he was not disabled?
The final decision maker was a Cigna claims person, but if in actuality the final decision maker was a physician named Marie Hattam. Dr. Hattam's report is in the record at page 167, and if you look at that report, it consists of about two sentences of barely legible handwriting indicating that she simply disagrees with the treating physicians without explaining why, and without explaining why 12 years of documented evidence which corroborated Mr. Jenkins' disability was no longer valid. For 10 years, Dr. Prelutsky's opinion was considered to be reliable and was followed by the plan, yet in 2006, Dr. Prelutsky's opinion was no longer considered
Your
valid.
Your client receives about a little over $1,000 a month benefits.
Approximately $1,400 a month, Your Honor.
What is the size of the medical expenses, however, that's incurred?
Well, you have to take into consideration Mr. Jenkins is also receiving Social Security disability and has been receiving that for pretty much the entire period. And with that comes Medicare coverage. But Medicare does not cover everything. And Mr. Jenkins participated in PricewaterhouseCoopers' medical plan that would pay what Medicare did not. So it was still a significant amount of money.
Do you have any idea roughly what annual cost would be?
It's not in the record, Your Honor. I would estimate it to be in the low thousands of dollars.
Well, my question goes to this. The value of what he's receiving looks to be less than $20,000 a year. Would that be a fair...
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Mr. Bosky, keep going.
Hello?
The General Services Administration's control of the speaker system here is somewhat random.
I'm trying to get a handle on what the planned objective is to save in this case.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, and the $20,000 figure is probably relatively accurate. But as the Supreme Court acknowledged in the Glenn decision, A dollar saved is a dollar that goes into the employer's pocket. It's somebody less, one individual less whose claim that they have to administer. And this is a claim that's scheduled to be paid for quite a few more years, I believe until 2027. So this is something that they're going to have to incur the expense of administering for that entire period, as well as the expense of paying out the benefits.
Well, it cuts two ways, too, because my guess is that the cost of this litigation probably exceeds what may be paid out since then.
That perhaps is correct as well. But I think if the court goes back to examine its precedents, the answer in this case is pretty clear. This court has had several cases involving similar circumstances of somebody receiving benefits for a lengthy period of time and then suddenly being cut off. And I refer specifically to the Halpin case, Halpin versus Granger, Hackett versus Xerox, Ladd versus ITT, recently the Tate case. And
was there any particular factor that caused this cutoff of benefits?
As far as I can tell, there was none. This isn't a situation, and in many of these situations, the disability plan would put the claimant under surveillance and see activities exceeding the claimed restrictions. There were four random dates of surveillance conducted here and no activity whatsoever.
How about the trip to London?
The trip to London may have perhaps triggered something in Cigna's mind. The record is unclear as to that. But if there was any doubt, we have the Shockley independent medical examination, and Dr. Shockley found that it was exceedingly doubtful that he could work 40 hours a week, which is exactly the same finding that a Cigna claim representative named Mike James made in October of 1999 at page 433 of the record. So this is something that Cigna has had in mind for a long time, and that the London trip obviously is documented as showing significant restrictions. And we cited in our brief to the Hawkins case that talked about the choice between becoming totally inert or trying to exert oneself a little further. And if the person tries to exert himself a little further, then it doesn't prove that he's not disabled. Let me just use the remaining time before rebuttal to talk about PricewaterhouseCoopers. The issue with PricewaterhouseCoopers here is that Mr. Jenkins was effectively precluded from ever having an opportunity to get back in the plan. It's absurd that if he won his appeal with Connecticut General or if he wins this litigation, he's forever foreclosed from ever returning to the status of a PricewaterhouseCoopers employee. And although we were unable to find a specific precedential case or even a statutory provision for this, it's well within the court's equitable powers to recognize this situation. PricewaterhouseCoopers is the plan administrator. They administer these plans. And the ERISA regulations and the ERISA civil action would be meaningless if Mr. Jenkins were not allowed to be reinstated. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Dubofsky. Mr. Palmer.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Rick Potler. I'm from the law firm of Thompson Coburn in St. Louis, and I have the privilege today of representing Connecticut General Life Insurance Company in the Pricewaterhouse Long-Term Disability Plan. The material facts are not in dispute, Your Honors. The parties agree that the plan document grants discretion to Connecticut General so the deferential standard review applies. The parties also agree that every physician to opine in this case agreed that Mr. Jenkins was capable both physically and mentally of working an 8-hour workday in a sedentary occupation.
How does that comport with the Social Security Award?
The Social Security Award was made a long time ago, Your Honor, and I'm not sure there had ever been reviewed.
Has it gotten better?
Your Honor, I believe what you will find is a lot of people thought that age was a death knell for people, and it just hasn't been the case because of medications, things have proved he is certainly stabilized. The question was, can this gentleman work 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year? And on that opinion, it was split. There were four medical professionals who said, yes, he definitely can. Three physicians and a physical therapist who performed a 2-day FCE. Dr. Shockley, who was an independent physician at Barnes Jewish Hospital. And when you read that record, Your Honor, Mr. Jenkins never contests her objectivity, never contests her qualifications or her independence. What she said is, it's just not certain. She didn't say it was extremely unlikely or doubtful. She said it's uncertain whether he'll be able to do it on a regular basis. And then his own physician, Dr. Prelutsky, said he definitely can't work. The problem was Dr. Prelutsky's opinion had become very suspect for a couple of reasons. First of all, he told Connecticut General that Mr. Jenkins could only walk a half a block, and yet Mr. Jenkins went to London.
How do we know he walked farther than half a block just because he went to London? He didn't walk there.
I believe that, Your Honor, but I don't think you can walk a half a block in any American airport today. I don't think anybody goes to
wheelchairs?
London. I don't think anybody...
Did you ever hear of wheelchairs?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, I have. And I've seen people, and I've seen them have to walk at least down the aisle of the airplane. I don't think somebody who believes they can only walk a half a block decides they're going to go vacation in London. And the other thing, Your Honor, is Mr. Jenkins submitted to Connecticut General report that he walked his father's dog a half a mile at a time. So those two things were inconsistent. The other thing, Your Honor, is Dr. Prelutsky told us that he could only stand for 30 minutes maximum, sit for 1 hour maximum, and that he was incapable of walking. But
you make this is your own language. Dr. Potulski opined that Jenkins could not walk one half a mile when, in fact, Jenkins traveled to London.
It says one half block, Your Honor,
I'm sorry. You're right. One half
That's
block.
Right. That's right. And I don't think that's consistent, Your Honor. My relatives who are so weak they can't walk a half a block don't travel outside the state, certainly not overseas for vacation. But the other thing is, Dr. Shockley said he could stand and walk 2.5 to 5.5 hours at a time, and he could sit for more than 5.5 hours at a time. Both are directly inconsistent with the extreme limitations put on Dr. Prelutsky. So what you have is four doctors who says he can, one who says she's not certain, and one who says that he cannot. Our position was he had at least to try. And there are three things about that I think
that
are important.
Two of them examined him, Dr. Shockley and his own physician?
Yes, that is correct.
So the other two didn't see him?
The other three read all the medical records. The physical therapist not only saw him, but conducted a two-day functional capacity exam that he completed throughout the whole entire 2 days. But the thing was, Dr. Shockley said, and this is, I'm a quote, his status as of the examination of June 2005 would not prevent his attempting full-time sedentary employment. And our position is that on this administrative record, it's not arbitrary and capricious to say he at least had to try. And there is another thing about that, Your Honor, is this policy had a provision that says if he goes back and tries, and within 90 days it's determined he's incapable of working, then he goes back on disability without any elimination period, without any waiting period. And so there was a safety net there for him if he went back and tried and couldn't do it. Your Honor, this was reviewed.
He had he's 12 years he's getting disability payments for what everybody thinks is a fairly progressive disease. Were there other attempts made during that 12-year period to reevaluate him?
Your Honor, I think that they simply consistently relied upon what Dr. Prelutsky was telling them.
But
until
they never launched surveillance or anything like that?
They did have surveillance.
Well, for this time they did. I'm talking about other times, 2 years into the plan, 5 years.
Your Honor, the record's this thick, not that I can recall any prior surveillance.
So what triggered the, if the record would tell us this, what triggered the inquiry here after maybe it's 12 years?
Your Honor, I don't think it's in the record. I think the fact is that people with AIDS are living longer and becoming more productive in the workplace, that it isn't a 12-month death sentence that it was in the 90s because of all the new medications and that people are using. So I think they periodically reviewed it, and they looked and said, man, there's no reason this guy isn't able to work. Let's have an IME, let's have an FCE, and determine if he is capable. They concluded that it's not certain.
His income when he was employed was significantly more than this $16,000.
I think it was about $32,000. And the disability benefits provide him a percentage of that, plus he gets Social Security. disability, which acts as an offset.
Okay.
Your Honor, I need to preserve the time of Pricewaterhouse. Unless there are any other questions, I would ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Roush.
May it please the court, Michael Roach for defendant PricewaterhouseCoopers, LLP. As an initial matter, I think we need to make clear, even though there's some conflation in the plaintiff's briefs, that the status of PWC LLP here is very different than that of Connecticut General and the LTD plan. Mr. Jenkins' claims...
Could you use real English words for these?
Yes, Your Honor, the non-long-term disability plans. After writing long briefs, one gets used to the abbreviations, I guess. There is a...
Abbreviations may go over for somebody who spends his life doing this kind of thing, but we don't. We actually have to understand it using normal words.
Understood, Your Honor. The bulk of Mr. Jenkins' claims are related to the long-term disability plan and against that administrator, which is Connecticut General or Cigna. He later in his case amended his complaint to add certain claims directly against PricewaterhouseCoopers. Those were for completely different plans, though, the general medical plan, disability plan, and the like, related to PricewaterhouseCoopers.
That was sort of my question indirectly to opposing counsel. Is that really the greater expense in this situation, the medical benefits, if he were to recover them?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but it's possible, given his age and years to run, it's possible it could be a significant expense. But here, PWC was allowed under the clear terms of its plan to terminate Mr. Jenkins' benefits. Those plans, like virtually all welfare benefit plans at companies across the country, are premised for the most part on being an employee of that company. Once Mr. Jenkins was no longer an employee, the very clear language of the plan dictated that he could no longer be a participant in those particular plans. That's separate from whether he can be put back on long-term disability coverage. PricewaterhouseCoopers had a very generous leave of absence policy, far beyond what the law required, in which they allowed employees to stay on as technical employees and on those other plans while they were on LTD, or long-term disability, no matter how long that went. And so Mr. Jenkins remained on those plans without working a single day for PricewaterhouseCoopers for over 12 years. The policy, though, is also clear that if the employee comes off of long-term disability, even temporarily, and that language is right there in the policy, even temporarily, at that point he has a six-month maximum leave of absence policy, and if he doesn't find a position within that time, his employment will be terminated. That policy operated here to end his employment and by the clear terms of the plan.
The argument by the plan is that he can do sedentary work, they say, for 40 hours a week. Wasn't that what he was doing before?
Your Honor, he may have been. It was over 15 years ago that he last worked at PWC. He apparently, during the six-month period, despite some encouragement, there's very little of this in the record, but he did not really pursue any positions at PWC. And Mr. Jenkins tries to assert that somehow the leave of absence policy should be subject to the ERISA regulations because it ends up affecting his ERISA rights. But that would be a radical break with existing law, because then any employment policy that could affect employment rights would be considered to be under ERISA. If an employee were terminated for bad attendance, for example, that would convert, he would lose benefits, and Mr. Jenkins' argument would convert the company's attendance policy into an ERISA plan, subject to all the regulations of the statute. That's clearly not the law and would upend most of the employment and benefits practice in the country. I know my time is up, and if there are no further questions.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, Mr. Dubofsky?
Just a couple of brief points. During the questioning of opposing counsel, a question was posed as to whether Mr. Jenkins improved over the course of the claim, and the fact is he didn't improve, and the fact is that the insurance company designated his condition as a SAM condition, and here goes another one of those abbreviations. It stands for stable and mature, indicating that the condition is a deteriorating condition and no improvement is expected. And that's documented at pages 313 and 597 of the record, and the policy itself is in the record at document 49. In fact, one of the insurance company's own physicians validated what Dr. Shockley had indicated about the fatigue-limiting activity. Dr. Taylor wrote, before the benefits were terminated, this is in September of 2005, and in the record at page 75, I am unable to add any additional information regarding the opinion of the IME, referring to Dr. Shockley, which was uncertainty whether the claimant could perform sedentary activities for 40 hours per week without frequent work breaks or work absences. What happened next? They reassigned the case to another doctor, to Dr. Kern, and then ultimately to Dr. Hatem, because they obviously didn't like Dr. Taylor's opinion. The argument about Mr. Jenkins had to try to work. This is one of those situations where the plan is sandbagging the claimant. In the initial denial letter, page 334, there's no mention made about trying to work. No mention was made about trying to work in the final decision, which is at page 165 of the record. All the plan did was say, your benefits are terminated. There was no warning prior to the termination. Why don't you try and work? And even so, the Govindarajan case makes it very clear that a release to a work attempt is not sufficient to justify a termination of benefits. And finally, with respect to the PricewaterhouseCoopers, the six-month leave of absence policy is inconsistent with the ERISA regulations, which gives the claimant 6 months to appeal, and then the plan has 90 additional days to decide the appeal. So even if...
Thank you, Mr. Dubofsky.
Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement. Our final case...